This is episode 297 of That Shakespeare Life. Just like the work of William Shakespeare, That Shakespeare Life is supported by listeners just like you who sign up to be our patrons. You can help support our show, contribute directly to programming, and access an entire library of bonus episodes not available on public listening platforms when you join us as a patron at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. To try out some of the history you learn about here on our show, you can join Experience Shakespeare, the membership here at That Shakespeare Life. We offer digital history activity kits that work like science labs for Shakespeare history. Learn more at CassidyCash.com/member and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey R. Wilson, the author of Richard III's Bodies from Medieval England to Modernity, Shakespeare and Disability History. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
Some of the gifts might be given to help the food that was so much needed when you had 12 days of entertaining.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Merry Christmas! I am thrilled you're spending a piece of your Christmas holiday here with us today. That's a lovely gift in and of itself to have you on the other side of the speakers today as we explore the Christmas tradition of gift-giving in 17th century England and exactly what Shakespeare would have received as a gift in December over 400 years ago. We are also going to explore what kinds of gifts were popular to be given throughout society for the Christmas holidays, from peasants all the way up to the Queen. We're delighted to be speaking with an expert in gift-giving for Shakespeare's lifetime and the author of The Power of Gifts, Gift Exchange in Early Modern England, Dr. Felicity Hill. Hello, Felicity. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Thank you for inviting me.
In the modern celebrations of Christmas, we give gifts on Christmas Day, but Shakespeare celebrated Christmas for over 2 weeks or more. Were gifts given only on a single day, or did they have gifts throughout this holiday season?
Well, one or the other. It wasn't always entirely clear, but it's certainly true that the 12 days is all a period of celebration, feasting, world turned upside down, all sorts of exciting things happening, masks and so on and so forth. And some of the gifts might be given to help the food that was so much needed when you had 12 days of entertaining. So there could be some general gifting of that kind. But nevertheless, there's one day, which is the only really significant day for giving gifts to your superiors and your friends and your contemporaries. And that is not Christmas Day, as it is with us, but it's New Year's Day. And that had traditionally been the great day for giving and exchanging gifts. And you will find that the court, the noble households, even the cities and towns and their mayors and so on, often exchange gifts on New Year's Day. So it's rather less every day than we might expect, given that they are apparently all reveling for the whole of the 12 days.
Were the gifts different at different times? For example, Twelfth Night, the celebrations were, as you're talking about, rambunctious and loud. But of course, the holiday itself, Christmas, is about the sacred religious celebration of Jesus's birth. So were there varying definitions of what would constitute an appropriate gift depending on when you were in celebration and from what could be potentially Christmas celebrations, October through February? I wonder if there was any time-related appropriateness about what you would give at different points in this juncture.
Yes, there is something of that kind, but it's not, I think, terribly significant. Christmas Day itself is obviously celebrated as a feast of the church, and there are the services and sermons and preaching and music that we might associate with the festival. But very rarely are gifts given at Christmas itself. And as far as the English are concerned, and I would stress that this I'm talking about for the moment is England rather than the whole of Europe. As far as England is concerned, it doesn't seem there are really alternative days on which significant gifts are given, or the sense of gifting as a collective activity is engaged in. I should say that that's different from some other European states, because in some European countries, there are two other festivals that are celebrated and used as occasions for gifting. One of them is 6th of December, which is the Feast of St. Nicholas of Bari, which sort of is the beginning of Santa Claus elsewhere. The other is the Feast of the Epiphany, which is Twelfth Night, where indeed the English are busy celebrating and whooping it up, but they don't seem to give gifts. And that is not the case in some European countries. In parts of Germany, for example, gifts on the Epiphany are quite common. So the English are a bit different from the rest of the continent in this respect.
Well, in England, what kinds of gifts would have been popular when they did give them to one another? In a family, for example, between William and Anne Hathaway and their children, would they have given gifts to each other? And what might that have been?
I think perhaps the choice of William and Anne Hathaway is an inappropriate one, since I'm not sure that they were always so close that they gave gifts to one another. However, of course, yes, gifts were given within the family. They're less often, I think, given it between husband and wife, curiously, than they are between children and adults, or sometimes adults and children, i.e. across the generations. If there was an occasion for giving gifts between husband and wife, it was often because they were not in the same place. Or maybe that's just we know about what happens when they're not in the same place because they have to write about it. But I think it's not just that. They do have the opportunity to pass particularly gifts of food between London and the country. And I think we might imagine that in there would have been circumstances in which William and Anne would have exchanged those sorts of gifts. Perhaps William might have sent from London spices that are only available in the capital. And from the country, very commonly, a wife or a mother would send cheeses, big cheeses, or would send birds, pheasants, something like that. And those would be exchanged within a fairly ordinary, not particularly affluent household. As far as children and their parents are concerned, adult children very often seem to have made handmade gifts. My favourite is that there seems to be an awful lot of nightcaps going around being given by daughters to fathers as presumably a mark of affection. But also there was the other way around, the flow from fathers to older children, and those would sometimes come in the form of advice. Gifts of advice at the new year have some connection, I suppose, with what we think of as new year resolutions and beginning to get a choice of guidance for the new year. I'm not sure they liked them very much, but that's what they got.
Of course, we expect Queen Elizabeth I to have been given some much more elaborate gifts than perhaps spices or bits of advice, I suppose. What were some of the more surprising presents that she received for the Christmas holidays?
Well, mostly what Queen Elizabeth received, as you might well guess, was wonderful jewellery and wonderful clothing, deep competition between her courtiers to pass her the most beautiful pieces of gold-threaded clothing, velvet, elegant things of all kinds, and jewellery above all. She loved bling. So those sort of things are predictable. Some people play safe and give money instead because they're so worried, I think, about how difficult it is to give something to the Queen that they think giving a purse is the safe answer. However, there are some oddities, not that many, but there are some oddities at the extreme. Particularly the women of the royal household would sometimes come up with curious pieces of garment that they had made. And sometimes you would get much smaller things, quince pies, for example, given by the pastry chefs, toothpicks, quite a lot of toothpicks, because Elizabeth's teeth were well known not to be very strong. So toothpicks came in one case from a visiting Italian. And there's a history of Pyramus and Thisbe made out of nutmegs and cloves. I've no idea what that looked like, but there were a few oddities amongst the wonderful and glorious pieces of clothing and of jewellery.
Wouldn't that have been wonderful to see Pyramus and Thisbe made from nutmeg and cloves? Felicity's book shares the power of gift giving and the political force behind giving of these gifts. Felicity, what are some examples of gifts that were given during the Christmas period that were politically motivated specifically?
Right. Yes, there's quite a lot of good examples of this. We have to be a bit careful by what we mean by politically motivated. Some of these things are fairly straightforward. They're requests almost for patronage. For example, the books presented to the Queen, and there are a lot of those dedicated to her, are obviously seeking endorsement and reward. That sort of thing is fairly predictable. But there are some more distinctive attempts to communicate through the gifts that are given. And I think the best way I can talk about that is just to take a couple of examples. The Sydney family were great givers of gifts in the New Year honours arrangements. And Henry, who had been the Queen's Lord Deputy in Ireland, and his famous son, Sir Philip Sidney, the poet that people may well know of, were amongst those who gave. They were also amongst those who found their political positions quite difficult in Elizabeth's reign. In Henry's case, because running Ireland was never easy. And in Philip's case, because he was very committed to what is sometimes called the Protestant cause, he was very committed to opposing Catholicism in Europe. So how did this connect with what they gave? Well, Henry, in 1578, gave a jewel to the Queen. That was very predictable. But it was a jewel with the image of Diana, the chaste goddess of the hunt, and a ship on the reverse. And this was obviously intended to compliment the Queen, who saw herself in part as the chaste goddess, Diana, but also to remind her that he was overseas and that he had served her through the ship overseas. Even more interesting, I think, is Philip. 3 years later, he's in disgrace because he has opposed the attempt by the Queen to think of marrying a Catholic, the Duke of Anjou. But Philip's gift was again a piece of jewellery, absolutely predictable, a gold jewel garnished with diamonds, but it was its shape. It was shaped like a whip. And the notion was clearly that the Queen could accept that he had erred and that this was as a form of punishment. Apology, yes, but in a curious form.
Are there any instances of specific gift-giving traditions from Shakespeare's lifetime that have become entirely obsolete today? Something that would have been normal for the Christmas period in the 16th and 17th century that we don't really think of as associated with the holiday now?
I'm not sure that there's anything that's absolutely obsolete. I think most cultures sort of define what a gift is, and we can see that the notion of gift is the important thing rather than perhaps what the individual item itself is. And I think in the 16th century, as now to some extent, anything can be a gift. We can define a gift by how we wrap it up, how we present it to somebody, how we exchange compliments about that thing. It's a gift. So in one sense, no, obsolete doesn't seem to make much sense here. On the other hand, I would stress, I think, that the food that is given New Year is in some ways very different, at least, from what we would expect. My favourite comes from Henry VIII's reign, where cabbages are given on one occasion. But cabbages are not that common an example. You would expect something a little more luxurious. So what we tend to see is birds and rare gifts of that sort of game. There might be offerings. Interestingly, the offerings of the turkey is becoming one quite common in this period, not obsolete now. But let me take the example of swan. I mean, that is not exactly obsolete, but it would not be expected to grace a modern menu, I think. And gifts of swans are not that uncommon in the 16th century. So it all depends how you define, I think. And anything can be given, but what this culture gives is a bit different, obviously, from what we give.
Yeah, I definitely think of turkey as something I would have at Christmas time. But the swan, I don't think I've ever heard of that being presented. So that's a surprising one for sure. Are there any specific Christmas celebrations? I think about maybe years or particular parties or events associated with the Christmas holidays from Shakespeare's lifetime that we should point to as particularly remarkable for one reason or another, where they just did it up big one year or another.
in many ways, I think the Christmas celebrations continue year on year in much the same way. I mean, this culture has traditions just as we have traditions. For example, just go back to the royal giving. Every year you've got tables set up for the giving ceremony so that everybody could look at all the gifts. I doubt that changes that much year on year. There must have been years, and we're guessing here a lot of the time, where things were, for good or bad, rather different. The Armada year in 1588, one can imagine, although it's difficult to prove, that the Christmas celebrations were pretty high that year. Equally, in the mid-1590s, when famine stalks the land, then there must have been, at least in ordinary households, little cause for celebration. But I suppose that the easiest thing is not to take gifts here, but to take what happens at court with the masks and the drama and the interludes that are so common a feature of Tudor hospitality. And there, well, we have Twelfth Night. We think 1602. Shakespeare's Twelfth Night is obviously written with the Christmas season in mind. Ben Jonson, who becomes a great writer of court masks under James I, produced masks for almost every Christmas season. But two that we know about, the Mask of Blackness in 1605, when the court dressed itself up in black and covered faces in black, and Oberon in 1611, which is the nearest to a full celebration for Prince Henry, James I's son. So, yes, there are festivities that we can point to particular years, and we can point to some celebrations, but I don't think things change very much between one year and another, and the economic circumstances of the country change, as indeed they do in the 1590s.
Well, I know we would love to learn more about Christmas celebrations and gift giving from the early modern period, and I wonder if you could share with us some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use if we're new to this topic and we want to dive in and explore it further. Where should we begin?
Right. It's always difficult to know exactly what is sensible here, but I would recommend the Folger Library's website, which is from their series Shakespeare and Beyond, which has a section on Elizabethan holidays. And that's very interesting because it shows the gift rolls that were recorded in Elizabeth's reign. So you can find out by looking at that some of the things that were given in that period. Another good source, although it's more about Henry VIII than about Elizabeth, would be Lucy Worsley's programme available on PBS and I think on YouTube, The 12 Days of a Tudor Christmas, which is full of very merry circumstances. And for anybody who really wants to read something in traditional book form, as it were, there's a good book by Maria Herbert, Christmas in Shakespeare's England, but it may not be that readily available on your side of the pond.
Well, we'll place links to these resources that we can find in the show notes for today's episode. And I believe Lucy Worsley's program is also available on BritBox if you happen to have that app at home as a place to watch it that is available on this side of the pond. And we will make sure that links to these get placed in the show notes. So stay tuned for the URL for where to see those. Felicity, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be in addition to those.
Right. Always a very difficult thing to choose, I think. I listen to the sort of programs that ask for this question, and obviously people struggle sometimes. But I think I would go for Michel Montaigne's essays, that is, essays written in the late 16th century, early 17th century, very much in Shakespeare's period, which reflect on almost all aspects of the human condition in new essay forms. It's like having a conversation across time, not always optimistic, but I think it would give one a sense of why you were there on the desert island and whether you could cope.
I think that would be a very philosophical choice to take with you to your deserted island. So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, I've gone back a little bit to doing some more on gifts and books in particular. I've been involved with an exhibition which is currently on at the Bodleian Library of gifts of books that were given with some very beautiful examples. So that I'm excited about. I shall probably end up going back to my other love, which is working on the Reformation in Britain and Europe in the 16th century, but I haven't quite got there yet. But gifts and books seems a good start.
I know we'll look forward to seeing more from Felicity Hill. Well, Felicity, thank you so much for sharing this Christmas gift giving episode with us and talking us through the history of what gifts would have been like on Christmas for William Shakespeare's lifetime. I hope that you enjoy the Christmas season as well. And we wish you a very Merry Christmas from all of us here at That Shakespeare Life.
Thank you very much, Cassidy. Yes, it was fun to do. And it's nice to think of Christmas on your side of the pond as well as on ours. A Merry Christmas.
I've gathered up visuals and artifacts to go along with our conversation today, including images of some of the gifts we talk about and some more information about the history of gifts in Tudor and Elizabethan England. If you'd like to explore these extra tidbits related to the show today, as well as to download a free Christmas art print I have available there for you as my Christmas gift to you today, then visit the show notes at CassidyCash.com/episode297. That's CassidyCash.com/episode297. And don't forget to download the free Shakespeare Christmas art print from me as my gift to you this holiday season. To really get your hands on the history we discuss in our show and make your own apple wassail, which is a holiday favorite, I make it every year here at our house, or to join in particular games that were played for the 12 days of Christmas, like card games or the Philosopher's Game, then consider becoming a member of Experience Shakespeare. Members get access to a library of hands-on history activity kits that work like science labs for Shakespeare history. Each kit comes with a video tutorial, supply list, and step-by-step instructions to let you complete the activity at home or in your classroom. The kits coordinate with both Shakespeare's plays and specific episodes of our show, and we include links to our resource library, so you get worksheets, lesson plans, maps, diagrams, and other extras to go along with each one of these kits. If you're a Shakespeare educator, or you just love diving into the 17th century and trying out some of the history for yourself, then learn more about being a member and sign up today at CassidyCash.com/member. That's CassidyCash.com/member. One of the coolest gifts you have given us this year is listeners like you have supported us all year long as patrons of our show. Patron support allows That Shakespeare Life to connect with the world's leading experts on Shakespeare history and bring you the best information on life and turn of the 17th century England. Each week, we are powered by the support you give us on Patreon, and your contributions make our work possible. If you enjoy learning history with us each week and want to play a direct role in selecting programming and really being an integral part of the work that we do here, then you can sign up to be a patron right now at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. From all of us here at That Shakespeare Life, we wish you a very Merry Christmas and a lovely holiday season full of joy, mirth, comfort, and love. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learn something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.